Connectivity and logistics, trade were always central to all geopolitics. You can go back to the entire history of humankind. In modern times, it looked like, post-Cold War in particular, looked like the world had become a stable place, a perfect place, where there were no upheavals were taking place and none were expected. That picture has changed now, because geopolitics has changed in the past decade, not just because of Russia's war on Ukraine, but several other things have happened. Also the rise of China, which has altered the global balance of power, the post-Cold War balance of power. In addition, now we have local factors, and we've seen how important local factors can be and what a bearing they can have on connectivity, logistics, and trade. So you have Houthis in Red Sea area playing havoc, and further down on the same body of water or same body of the seas, we have the pirates coming back to life in Somalia. Again, if you look at a completely different region in the world, the Panama Canal, that is struggling because of water shortage. Suez Canal has had trouble. We had a ship blocked there not long ago, and that caused a big disruption. So the whole world is becoming conscious of these disruptions. In this situation, the countries of the world, particularly the big powerful countries of the world, one, they want to secure themselves against disruptions. Second, they also want to build corridors of connectivity to give themselves leverage in the new balance of power, because in the new balance of power, connectivity will be key. That's the reason we are hosting this episode of Karta Clutter, focused on particularly three of these corridors that involve India and which are all work in progress. One as a concept, one where some work has been done, and the third one where some work might have been done, but not that much has been done. But all three involve India. In fact, in all three, India has a central position. This is also part of India's vision of connecting the Pacific with the Atlantic. Or let me say, the Pacific with the Atlantic. If you imagine this to be north, then this is the east. So from India, the Pacific and the Atlantic. So India becomes the bridge between the two. To that extent, India also becomes the bridge between the Eastern world, the big Eastern economies, the Eastern tigers, and the big Western economies. And that is how these three corridors mattered. I would also comment to you to read some of the comments that Joe Biden made in Delhi when the IMEC was announced, that is the India, Middle East, Europe corridor. And he said that economic corridor, he called it a big deal, but he also said economic corridor. You will hear this word often in years to come. And that was so correct. Now, as you hear this word often, you will also hear some acronyms. And I will mention three of these to you. One is IMEEC, which I just described to you, India, Middle East, Europe corridor. We, in fact, hosted a full episode of Karta Clutter on it, of which I'll share a link with you. INSTC, that is International North-South Transport Corridor. And number three, India, Myanmar, Thailand, Trilateral Highway. These are the three that we will talk about. There's one more acronym that I might as well mention to you upfront. That is PGII. That is the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment. This is an idea of G7, the richest countries in the world, who are now willing to finance some of these projects. Now, to explain what these are, I have with me two really wise old colleagues of mine. It's a joke, but only half a joke. Wise is not a joke. That is serious. Old is a joke. So P.R. Krishnan Kutty, or who you've seen on Karta Clutter before, and Keshav Padmanabhan, both of them have collaborated to do a series of four articles for the print, of which I will share a link with you. And as we speak, you will also see the front pages of the articles on your screens. They have one given us an overview of these projects, and then they've written in detail about each project. So as we go ahead, get familiar with some of the maps and graphics we will be using with this episode. So Pia, will you explain these graphics to us?
The first graphic that we're looking at is all three corridors on one map. Towards the west, you have the IMEC, which goes all the way from Mumbai to, well, it's yet to be seen, but likely to be Greece. And that is the IMEC. Then we have the INSTC, much longer, has a lot more countries involved. Again, beginning from Mumbai all the way to St. Petersburg in Russia. It passes through several countries, especially Iran. Then the South Caucasus, where you have Azerbaijan and Armenia. And along the Caspian Sea, a very important water body. Just keep that in mind as we go along. And finally, to the east, we come to the trilateral highway between India, Myanmar, and Thailand. Why is this important? You would have noticed that this does not include any sea routes. It's a fully land connectivity corridor. And it's important, as we'll continue to talk about China's economic corridors, namely the Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI, and also the fact that from time immemorial, whenever countries have traded, whenever there have been shipping lines and shipping routes, there has had to be some sort of naval protections, or at least some, as Shekhar Sir mentioned, some protections and some leverage that countries use when it comes to these corridors. Now, India has maybe 1/3 the naval fleet of China. And that's important because India then needs to make inroads across land. And as we continue to talk, just keep in mind these three on the world map. And let's go to the next one as well. This is the IMEC. Keshav, would you like to just explain this since you've done a detailed story on it?
Yes. So the India-Middle East-Europe economic corridor is envisioned as two specific geographic corridors, the Eastern Corridor and the Northern Corridor. So when you look at the map, you will see from Mumbai to the UAE. So basically, India to the Gulf is considered to be the Eastern Corridor. And from the Gulf to Europe is considered to be the Northern Corridor. So keep that in mind when we talk about the IMEC and in terms of the two corridors. The focus of this, if you see from India to the Gulf, is completely a sea corridor from Mumbai to the UAE. From there, the goods will be transported by rail all the way to, which point is still undecided, because ideally what the memorandum of understanding says is that it would connect Jordan and Israel as a part of this, even though both countries have not been a part signatories of the original MOU. So ideally, the focus is the Haifa port, which is owned by an Indian multinational company. And from there, we would have, again, a sea route to Europe. Again, the final destination is still unclear. We've had countries like Greece take a claim when the Prime Minister was here in India in February to be the doorstep to Europe. So when we look at the India, Middle East, Europe economic corridor, just keep these places in mind. And when you look at the map in the screen, you'd understand how these would function.
That's what you've written about.
Yes, sir.
This corridor. And this Greek port, PI, if I'm correct, this Greek port has a complication because the port is owned by a Chinese company.
It's operated by China Costco Shipping, if I'm not wrong, Costco or Limited.
And also the Indian multinational that owns one part of the Haifa port is the Adanis.
Yes.
Is the Adanis. So what are the other challenges with this project?
So when we look at the IMEC, firstly, it was conceived in September 2023. So it's still fresh. It's still being conceptualized. And secondly, it goes through the Gulf countries. And for the longest time, the Gulf Cooperation Council or any of the Arabian Gulf countries didn't really have land linkages. So one of the biggest challenges is the rail connection from the UAE to the final destination on the Arabian Gulf, which could be Israel, which requires two things. One, building those railway lines. And while the Gulf countries have done it to an extent, especially in the UAE, they've opened the Etihad rail earlier last year. They've had a connection to Saudi Arabia and those lines being built. And in December 2023, the Gulf Cooperation Council said they want to open the full corridor by 2030. But then from there, it has to carry on to Jordan and Israel. And Israel and Saudi Arabia have not normalized ties. So this is a big issue, is how can you have this connection when two countries have not normalized ties? So they were close to it before you had the war in Gaza breaking out.
Yeah. And just to remind all of us, Joe Biden once said that he thought for a moment that the
Hamas attack was designed to thwart this because they saw that Saudis and Israelis making up. And if that had happened, then the picture in the Middle East would have changed much too dramatically for their liking and for Iran's liking, because after all, Iran is their principal, isn't it?
The other question, sir, over here is, where do we go into Europe? Because Italy is already a member state. Then, as you said, there's the complications with the port of Piraeus. So the final leg of the corridor is still being conceptualized. There's still no clarity. And because of all the conflicts that we've seen in the last 5 or 6 months, how does this proceed forward? So in that sense, those are the major challenges.
So this particular route will have two sizable water marine elements to this connectivity. Will you go to the next graphic?
Now, the INSTC, the International North-South Transport Corridor, was initially a transport corridor agreed to by India, Iran, and Russia. Today, there are about 13 signatories to this project. So the idea was to send goods from Mumbai through Iran and to Russia. And why was India very gung-ho about this project? Because it bypassed Pakistan. Instead of having to go through the land route, India would be able to access Central Asian markets through INSTC. This was the theory. As you can see on the map, though, there are very many stops after Iran. You have Azerbaijan, which has several ports, especially on the west coast of the Caspian Sea. And you have, even within Russia, the Astrakhan port, through which, in fact, in July 2022, Russia sent goods to India through this port down to Iran and to Mumbai.
That was like a dry run, like a proof of concept.
That was the first commercial shipment. Yeah. Two dry runs were conducted in 2014 and 2017. And in fact, in our story, we contacted the man from the Indian side who led the 2014 dry run. And he said the studies from the two dry runs concluded that this route was more cost and time effective than the Suez Canal route for Indian goods. However, there have been several logistical challenges. You have two sanctioned countries, Iran and Russia. Even within Iran, there's a lot of poor rail connectivity, which means even though goods can very quickly go from Mumbai to Iran, Bandar Abbas port, which will take maybe 3 days, going through Iran, especially with dilapidated rail systems that have not been able to have been upgraded due to crippling economies and the sanctions, there's a lot of issues there and there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be upgraded. Now, Russia, interestingly, last year agreed to fund a railway line between Azerbaijan and Iran. And this was considered the missing link of the INSTC because it was the missing link between the Azeri railway lines and the Iranian railway lines. The idea is once those get connected.
And Azeri railway lines, as we can imagine, because it was part of the Soviet Union itself had a brilliant railway system, railway network. So once you get onto the railway system in a Central Asian country, a former Soviet republic, that means you are onto that system and that you can go seamlessly into Europe, provided there are no sanctions, etc. So see where this railway line is located. This is almost running on the coast of the Caspian.
Right.
It's like a coastal railway line. Mm-hmm. And tell us the places that it's connecting.
It's connecting Rasht, an Iranian city, and Astra, an Azeri city. And as you'll see on your screen, there's a detailed graphic. It's a very short distance.
170 kilometers, I think.
Right. But a critical section of this corridor. And interestingly, Azerbaijan and its neighbor, Armenia, as you know, are quote-unquote regional foes. So they have both sort of competed for leverage in this INSTC corridor. In fact, Armenia has sort of pitched to India that since goods are very unlikely to go through Russia and into Europe through the INSTC, Armenia has pitched an alternate corridor within INSTC through which Indian goods can go through Armenia, then Georgia, and through the Black Sea to Varna port in Bulgaria. So that is an interesting proposition by the Armenian side, especially as we see this railway.
Although that brings in one more marine route there. If you were able to go into, say, straight into Azerbaijan, with which India does not have the friendliest relations right now, because there is also an Azerbaijan, Turkey, Pakistan kind of axis. At least that's what's believed in India. India is also selling arms to Armenia. Then you could have limited yourself to one marine route. That's from the Indian West Coast, whether it's Mumbai or Mundra or any of the other ports on the West Coast. So that is the increased degree of difficulty in this area. If you then again have transshipment into a ship and then go through Black Sea, and Black Sea, as we know, is also a war zone right now, and we don't know how long for. So you can see this entire region has geopolitical challenges. But the fact is that you cannot start planning something in a perfect world. And you cannot stop planning something because it is not a perfect world. One, because you are never sure when it will become a perfect world. And if so, for how long will it remain so? Because it changes. So the best time to start planning for a long-term, generational, multi-generation project, in fact, is yesterday. So that is how it's important that all this thinking has now begun. That said, Keshav, will you tell us about the next graphic? That is the tri-state, tri-nation highway on the eastern side.
Yes. So if you look at the screen, you will have the trilateral highway, which starts from Moreh in Manipur and goes through Myanmar and reaches Mysore in Thailand. It's about a 1,360-kilometer route, which was first envisioned in 2002. And then in 2012, they agreed to constructing this project. Till date, it's still incomplete. The original date to finish it was 2015. Then it became 2020. And then we had the pandemic. And now it is assumed to be 2027. And in between this, a large part of the route goes through Myanmar, which has been, let's say in the early days, not very cooperative. And then in 2010, when you had the military-backed civilian government, you had some sort of skeptical cooperation. And then now you have the situation in Myanmar. So in that sense, this route is a complete land route. And as Pia said at the start, one of the reasons is because of this, you know, India is not as powerful when it comes to marine shipping routes vis-a-vis China. And secondly, this also acts as sort of a solidarity road to the Southeast Asian region, which could give India the final puzzle in connecting the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Is that what Jaishankar said?
Yes. So our external affairs minister last month in Tokyo said that connecting this is a veritable change. The idea being that it becomes a bridge from the west to the east with IMEC connecting to the trilateral highway, and potentially the trilateral highway expanding to include Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. So it's this idea that you would have all the way from Southeast Asia, access to Europe, which is also one of the visions of the BRI. So in that sense, you're trying to induce that curiosity and change into that.
Yeah, so a lot of it is competition for BRI and OBOR. Now, the difference is that there, the Chinese bring the money. In this case, money will have to be raised. So for this tri-nation highway, I think ADB, Asian Development Bank, is willing to put up quite a bit of money. It'll be debt, but it'll be reasonable debt. It'll be reasonable debt, not like a Chinese debt, because the debt the Chinese bring is of a different type. Interest rates are high and they are unforgiving. So they are not going to either delay your debt, unless roll over your debt, unless it's a valuable strategic ally or a client state, a strategic client state like, say, Pakistan. They just rolled over some of the debt to Pakistan. Otherwise, they will not do it. They will just come and repossess your assets, as they've done, say, with Hambantota in Sri Lanka. Now, this is a counter to say that you don't have to borrow from the Chinese and be in their eternal debt and worry about losing your sovereignty, because this is backed by multilateral loans and multilateral guarantees. And on the other side, it's G7 who are willing to put up the money. Also, G7 and the Middle Eastern oil-rich countries, Saudi Arabia and UAE, who are willing to put up this finance again in a structured manner. So those are the big differences. That said, Keshav, there is also a problem with this tri-nation highway, which is local, which is on the ground. Because this part of Myanmar or Burma, I'm still used to calling it Burma, this part of Myanmar has many insurgent groups. It's always had many insurgent groups. They've never fully quietened, but at this point, they are really, insurgency is really at its peak. Not only is insurgency at its peak, in fact, it's fighting the Burmese army, and Burmese army is increasingly being pushed back from this area. So this is becoming like, quote-unquote, liberated zone, and you don't know who you might have to negotiate with. So that uncertainty is there. But that said, it's not as if we don't have a problem on our side, because Manipur is critical to this. So Moray that you mentioned, Moray is in headlines for all the wrong reasons these days, because that's where we see a lot of incidents of violence between Kukis and Metis, etc. So it's a troubled zone on the Indian side, which is shorter distance, and I'm hoping, and we can hope that on the Indian side, in the course of time, maybe in months, max, there will be stability. But on the Myanmar side, the challenge may be greater. Idea is quite grand that, you know, you have this connectivity from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And that's exactly what Xi Jinping is trying to do, because he has spare money, not just foreign exchange reserves, but he has surpluses. So he is like an enormous sovereign wealth fund, which he can invest in these projects. So that is the competition right now. And that is why these projects have a very strong element of geopolitical competition, isn't it, Pia?
Exactly. I mean, we don't just have to look at the trilateral highway. We can even look at INSTC, which I mentioned. Chabahar port.
In Iran.
Another port which is critical to Indian vested interests, because we have invested in one port there called Shahid Beheshti. This port we operate and we own. And in fact, just 100 kilometers away is Gwadar port in Pakistan, which is part of the BRI or the CPEC. So you've got strategic competition 100 kilometers away along the Iranian coastline as well. That's one example. Keshav also pointed out how with the IMEC, whether it's Haifa in Israel or the Piraeus in Greece, you have Chinese and Indian strategic and sometimes competing interests. So across these projects, you have these issues.
Both of you are too young to remember a film called, or to have heard of a film called Tere Ghar Ke Saamne. So this is very much like this, I'll build a port overlooking your port, next to your port, is like, reminds me of that old Devanand Nutan film, Tere Ghar Ke Saamne, where one man decides to build a house grander than the other one's house, right? In front of his house. And Devanand is actually the architect who's building it. So this is very much a Tere Ghar Ke Saamne kind of situation, a competitive situation. So this is in some ways China versus the rest, or China up against the rest, or is it China plus the global south, plus Russia sometimes, plus China, Russia, Iran, because those three are also quite a troika right now. So this is quite a geopolitical mishmash at this point. And chances are that many of these things will progress simultaneously.
So the interesting question in all of these ports, all of these projects, is that there is a complete absence of Pakistan. All of the routes try to go around Pakistan, to the, whether it's the Arabian Gulf or whether it's Iran. So in that sense, you know, it's a very interesting project of trying to compete, because you have CPEC on one side and you have India now, you know, trying to ignore and find their own routes around.
Yeah, so look at Pakistan. In fact, Pakistanis should be thinking hard about this. Pakistan's biggest asset, the greatest asset of all times, is their geostrategic location. Now, they should wonder, they should think about, or they should reflect on the possibility that they've blown it. And why have they blown it? They've blown it because of their own obsession in their own neighborhood. And that obsession is not just liberating Kashmir or cutting India to size. It's not just about, quote unquote, liberating Kashmir. It was all about cutting India to size. Because I remember in the 80s also, if you went to Pakistan and if you saw a match in which India was playing, It could be cricket. It was also hockey. I watched the 1989 World Cup in Pakistan. The chant when India came on to play was "Hilti hui diwar hai, ek dhakka aur do." In fact, I wonder sometimes that even the car sevaks who pulled down Babri Masjid, from where did they learn that chant, "Ek dhakka aur do"? Because when we were watching, people were watching sport on TV channels, sport being played in Pakistan, they were all hearing this "Ek dhakka aur do, hilti hui diwar hai, ek dhakka aur do." So there is this fantasy about cutting India to manageable pieces, right? Cutting India to size. At the same time, there was one fantasy, a country might have still survived it. In case of Pakistan, there's a dual fantasy. The other fantasy is controlling Afghanistan and installing in Afghanistan a regime that is not just friendly to them, but that is like a client state. Now, that is something that's an operation they've been actively running now since 1979. That is 45 years. And you've seen what's happened to Pakistan as a consequence of that. In fact, if you look at last 45 years, Pakistan might have paid a bigger price for the adventurism in Afghanistan than in India. Because in India, after all, you're only fighting one nation. In Afghanistan, you're fighting either a superpower or on behalf of another superpower or on behalf of some terrorists against a superpower which happens to be your best friend also. That's the Taliban and the Americans. And then you say, I've installed my own government. So they've succeeded in installing their favored governments at least twice. They installed the Mujahideen once. They installed the Taliban now. And when Taliban were installed, Imran Khan then said, this is the end of servility. And there was a celebration that this was a big Islamic victory, etc., etc. What's happened with the Taliban now? Now, Pakistan is at war with the Taliban. Pakistan's gone to the UN saying, please control the Taliban. They are sending terrorism into our country. So Pakistan is a country that has lost out on a great opportunity, because Pakistan had a great opportunity of actually becoming very important and very rich by just being a transit country. Because if Pakistan was a stable transit country, then all this elaborate multiple sea route come surface route would not have been necessary. People in the past used to drive from, buses used to go from Delhi to London. They'll just go to the French coast and then get onto a ferry and get to Britain, right? It was a very regular thing. You still find pictures of people doing it. But by choosing to be unstable, an island of instability, Pakistan has excluded itself. That's why everybody is now planning to bypass Pakistan. And Pakistan's cussedness is such that they would not even let India send wheat aid, yes, or wheat flour aid to the Afghans. So Pakistanis have chosen to exclude themselves. Maybe when the nature of Pakistan's polity and the Pakistani society changes, there will be some kind of an epiphany that we are missing out on a very big possibility. And it's now easy to bypass a country. There was a time when Pakistanis would have thought that technology, costs, etc., etc., who will bypass us? You cannot reach Central Asia. India cannot reach Central Asia without going through Pakistan. So that was the leverage. That leverage is gone now.
And I'm glad you brought up Afghanistan as well, because as I mentioned, the Chabahar port is a strategic asset for India. We've been trying to include it in the INSTC. Right now, there's only Bandar Abbas, which is the traditional port. In fact, our NSA Ajit Doval, just last year, when he was part of a meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, he made a very impassioned plea for the Chabahar port to be included in INSTC. And in fact, Indian aid, humanitarian aid, is now going through Chabahar port to Afghanistan. In fact, one time, it was only one time that they sent trucks through the Wagah border. There was an issue. There was a delay. Whatever goods ended up there were less than, and India took another route.
Well, I mean, it's a bit stupid, and this is competitive cussedness, because at one point they even stopped India from sending high-protein biscuits for Afghan children. So people, countries will find a way around it. Now, having mentioned Chabahar, as I read in your stories, Chabahar actually is a is more of a deep water port than even Bandar Abbas. Yes. And Chabahar can take large container ships.
Right. It's a deep sea port, which means it can take larger container ships. It's closer to Mumbai. It's 600 km east of Bandar Abbas. So it's closer. That's why maybe it'll take a freight less than a day than what you would usually take when going to Bandar Abbas. And after all, Indian investment in Chabahar, no wonder we are pushing it as much as we can in, as I mentioned, SCO or in other multilaterals as well.
And who knows, today Russians are helping the Iranians with their railways because they are both sanctioned countries, right? So they are two of a kind. But in the course of time, it might become possible for India also to help Iran develop its railways because India has such a lot of experience and so many people and personnel available for that. So Keshav, in conclusion, which one of these three do you think is the most unlikely to happen? Where is the degree of difficulty the highest?
So I would argue it would be in the IMEC, the India Middle East Europe Economic Corridor, because a lot of it are what ifs. What if Saudi Arabia completes its railway? What if it normalizes ties? What if Israel is a part of it? So there's too many what ifs with IMEC in comparison to INSTC, where you have real infrastructure or parts.
And a shipment went.
And shipment went, or the trilateral highway, which we claim is 70% done. So in that sense, you would look at it, I would say it would be the IMEC.
And Pia, which one do you think is the most difficult?
Especially because with the trilateral highway, you have three countries. With IMEC, you have several countries, funding issues, logistical issues, conflict, not just in Israel and Gaza, but in the Red Sea as well. So the water bodies around that entire region are compromised. INSTC, as I mentioned, in 2022, the first shipment went. Though granted, we should remember that the INSTC has been working more for Russia to send goods to India. Not a lot of Indian exporters are keen to send goods the other way. But IMEC is the only one with the biggest question mark on it.
You've heard about these difficulties with these projects. But, you know, we'll all agree that these difficulties mainly come from geopolitics. Iran and Russia are sanctioned, right? Saudi Arabia and Israel can't talk right now. Although they're talking behind the scenes, all of us know that. They've been doing so for years now. Once again, Azerbaijan and Armenia, Caspian Sea and Black Sea. So it's all a complicated thing. On the eastern side, what will happen in Myanmar? Manipur will settle. Manipur is not going to fester like this for a long time. Manipur will settle, that we can be quite sure of. The fact, however, is that geopolitics is a generation to generation thing. Geopolitics doesn't get settled over the next 5-year period. So it's not like somebody giving you a housing loan and saying you must build this house in the next 12 months or the next 18 months. When you have projects of geostrategic and geopolitical importance, then you start building in the expectation not only that the geopolitical issues will resolve, as they continue to do in our history, right? Even since the Second World War, these issues arise and then they resolve as well. But also, I do believe, and I do hope you agree, and if you don't agree, please feel free to say so. These projects like these and the kind of money they bring in and the kind of prospects they have and the kind of possibilities they open up for countries also becomes an incentive for countries to get their act together and to get geopolitical issues to resolve. Because trade is the new currency of global power. Because as even the Chinese multi-billionaire Jack Ma said, God bless him, because Xi Jinping no longer seems to be in love with him, you know that. As he said, that when trade stops, then hostility begins to travel.
Absolutely. And I would agree that even if we look at INSTC, Azerbaijan and Armenia, they're competing, but they're in a way also improving their own infrastructure. So it's also a benefit to their own people in a way. So there are these small benefits and silver linings we can see, even though these grand ambitious projects can take years, sometimes decades.
You have the last word, Keshav.
The issue is, even with the political will, it's at the end of the day, it's the billions of dollars of investment. So the BRI is close to $1 trillion, and that's seemingly pocket change for President Xi Jinping, but not
necessarily. Because he's collecting his collateral.
He is.
Right? He's buying up the global south.
He is. And whereas IMEC, for example, you need billions of dollars in railway lines. So while the prospect is the incentive itself, it is the first step that is how expensive will it be? And therein lies, I think, the crux when it comes to BRI versus the rest.
Fantastic. That's a very good point, that on which note we can conclude this. So once again, I'll remind you, all the four stories are given with the description of this video. Please read those stories, watch those maps again. And remember, this is a subject, this is an issue on which we will be holding many such conversations in times to come. Because these three projects will have a strong bearing in defining the new balance of power in the world. And you know what? India is at the center, at the heart of all three.